come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. Lord, we thank you for this call, for the great call to follow you, to come after you, to deny ourselves and take up our cross daily, that we might follow you. Lord, we thank you that you have called us to that which is truly countercultural. That if we would like to save our lives, we should lose it for your sake. That we should give all things. That we should sacrifice self for the sake of the greater glory in the time to come. Lord, we thank you for this different way of thinking and of seeing the world. And pray that it would be true in our lives in these days as we go forth. Amen. So, last time, we spent some time talking about this issue of the Islamic conquest. In the 6th and 7th centuries, an unexpected thing happened to the church, which was that the Arab tribes who had previously been of no real consequence in the history of the world and had been largely ignored, suddenly rose up, got organized, created a great army, and conquered more than half of the Eastern Roman Empire, sweeping across the Middle East, through Syria, up into Mesopotamia, conquering the entire Persian Empire, and sweeping all the way across North Africa to what is now Morocco. And subsequently crossing the Strait of Gibraltar and conquering what is now the Iberian Peninsula, Portugal, and Spain as well. These armies that came out of the desert continued to go forward. In great places of the history of the church were suddenly conquered by outsiders who believed in a new and different faith. Jerusalem, Antioch, Damascus, Alexandria, Paul's old home of Tarsus, Ctesiphon, that had become a great center of the church in the east, Edessa, many cities that had been important places in the growth of the church to that point suddenly fell under the rule of people from a different and new religion. And so we spent some time last time talking about some of the things that happened as a result of that, and sort of the whipsaw of the 4th century period from the conversion of Constantine that runs from the beginning of the 300s up through the beginning of the 700s. Is it 4 centuries of advance and decline and advance and decline, where people in the church are attempting to understand what seemed like great victories, the conversion of Constantine, the whole Roman Empire falls under the church, which is followed by the western part of the empire collapsing and being overrun by barbarian tribes who are unbelievers, which is followed by a significant evangelization of those unbelievers and the Eastern Empire under Justinian reconquering much of that area, which is followed by this great Islamic conquest sweeping away a great deal of these things. And one of the things that happened as a result of this is it set up this back and forth between Christianity, or between Europe, or the Western civilization, if you will, and Islam, or the Islamic forces of conquest. So next slide. One of the things that is part of the story of the church ever since the rise of Islam in the early 600s is this back and forth between Islam and the West. And so, the 600s and the 700s are characterized by this Islamic conquest. But there's a larger thing going on here, and that is, this is really a battle, if you will, or a back and forth between Islam and Western civilization, but most people see it as between Islam and Christianity. They see it as two great religions fighting back and forth, and it's more a proxy than it is an actual fight between churches, because most of the fights are between nation states, empires. They're not actually fights between churches per se. But it's a little difficult for Muslims to see it that way, because in Islam, Islam's perspective is that government, the military, all these elements, other elements of society are embedded in and connected to religion. They're not separate. So in the Christian world, there is mostly some focus on some separation between the secular authority and the religious authority. But in Islam, that's not really a concept that has ever existed in any significant way. And so, Jesus, he is a religious, spiritual leader, and he pushes back on opportunities to become some kind of political leader. His followers want him to raise up an army, to create some kind of rebellion against Roman rule, throw off the Romans. But he absolutely refuses to do this. But Muhammad, in creating Islam, Muhammad operates from the very beginning with the idea that this religion is also government, and it requires an integrated army that is part of what we're doing. So from the very beginning, Islam starts with the idea that all these pieces fit together, and that they can't really be taken apart. They can't really be divided. But these are kind of the big flows that happened really since the 7th century, the big back and forth. And a lot of this is sort of civilizational conflict. To use terminology that became more popular in the 90s, thinking about kind of great civilizations of the world and how they bump up against each other. But from the Muslim perspective, for the most part, this has been an issue of Islam's interaction with the rest of the world. It has been Christianity primarily that has been, to some extent, the great enemy. It's certainly been Western civilization that has been the great enemy. And so this is an ongoing conflict that continues to recur. So you've got, in the 7th and 8th century, you've got this Islamic conquest, and the Arab forces sweep out of the desert, overturn Syria. One of the reasons that Syria, the great province of the Eastern Roman Empire, what we think of now as the Byzantine Empire, is so easily plucked is because the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, has just gone through multiple decades of war against the Persian Empire. And those two empires have fought back and forth for decades in a thing that, one got an advantage and then the other, and they went back and forth. And that resulted in, at the end of that period, almost exactly the same borders as at the beginning. This was a gigantic commitment of blood and treasure that accomplished virtually nothing. The wars between the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and the Persian Empire, the outcome was, at the end, we are basically back to where we started, except for we have a lot fewer people and a lot less money. We spent gigantic resources, achieved nothing, and we are now significantly weaker. As a result, Syria is relatively easily conquered, and the Persian Empire is prone to collapse and is relatively easily conquered. And Egypt is not effectively defended by the Eastern Roman Empire. And so this great conquest happens, and partly it's because the military challenges of this conquest are not nearly what they would have been if this conquest had been launched, 50 or 60 years earlier. Because the forces to oppose it are a lot less. And the Islamic conquest is, at the beginning, very, generally pretty benevolent and tolerant. There is a great focus on killing soldiers, those who might become part of a force to push back. But other than that, this is a pretty tolerant thing through the 7th, 8th, 9th, and even into the 10th century in most places, because the Muslim forces are focused on gaining military control and then gaining political control, with the idea that that will eventually lead, in the future, to the religious conversion of all these people. But they're not in any great hurry to get to that point. So persecution of Christians doesn't really start until after about AD 900. And it is this sort of high watermark in the early 700s that has become kind of the baseline for a lot of Europeans and Americans as they think about, sort of the dividing line between, what you might think of as the Christian world and the Muslim world. That is, people tend to think of North Africa, Egypt, Syria in the Middle East, Mesopotamia. They think of all these areas as today, most people do, as these are inherently Muslim areas. And so when you think that way, you're thinking that somewhere around AD 700 is the beginning of all things, because that's at the point that those are Muslim areas. But if you push back even 100 years before that, none of those areas are Muslim areas. And all those areas are Christian areas that have been Christian areas for centuries. And so this is one of the reasons why today we have difficulty talking about this. And so you've got this huge Muslim conquest that this primarily happens in the 7th and 8th century. So, and then in the 11th century, you start to see some pushback. There is some military response. The military response to that point is basically attempts to defend Constantinople and attempts to defend the line of the Pyrenees, the mountains between what is now Spain and France, as sort of a defensive line. And so over the centuries from the 7th century to the 11th century, there is an attempt to defend Constantinople from Muslim forces that keep attacking and to defend the line of the Pyrenees, but not much else happens. In the year 1095, the then Pope calls for what becomes known as a crusade. He doesn't use that term. In fact, that term doesn't become common until the 13th century, until well after the fact. But he calls for a mass pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so in 1096, we start a two-century period that we call the Crusades. And the Crusades are really an attempt to regain Jerusalem and some parts of the coastal parts of the old Roman province of Syria. And so it's a series of attempts to roll back parts of the Islamic conquest and reclaim some key sites of historic Christianity. So these are European attempts to regain some of what is lost and are really framed as religious obligations to people in Europe. the leaders of these things came and made pledges to the Pope at Rome or to other prominent bishops, but they made a religious commitment. And these are based on some groundswells of religious fervor. There's a bit of revivalism that goes on that fuels these crusades. And the objective here, on the most part, is to walk where Jesus walked. To walk again where in the places where the church was founded. So a huge focus in the Crusades on places that are named in the New Testament, places that I can read about in my Bible. And so, you know, the Crusades are never actually about the idea of, you know, defeating Islam or, you know, something like that. It's about getting hold of the places that are named in the New Testament: Caesarea Maritima, Tarsus, Antioch, Jerusalem, maybe Damascus, that these places that have some significant part in the New Testament story, these are important places, and we need to open them up to Christian pilgrims again, as in the days of Constantine. We need people to be able to go and travel and worship in these places. So the Crusades, you know, create some small states in coastal Judea and Samaria, some of which last for more than a century. The whole period of the Crusades runs from 1096 at the beginning to 1291, which is the fall of Acre, and that is the end of the entire Crusader thing. So this is two centuries of European efforts to control Jerusalem, which is only intermittently achieved during that time. And ultimately, you know, this is a complete failure, really. You know, after two centuries, we're back to basically where we started. Much blood and treasure once again spent on something that leads to the status quo, really. There's at least four major crusades, at least eight crusades that are numbered today, but there's a long list of other crusades, and most of them end in defeat and disaster. In Europe, people call the Crusader states the kingdoms that are founded and maintained for decades or in one instance for almost two centuries as Outremer, the land beyond the sea. But in the Muslim world, the Crusades are regarded as a great offense against Islam. And led to significant persecutions of Christians in the larger Muslim-controlled world. And so the church in the West, the Latin church that is led from Rome, launches military expeditions to try to recover Jerusalem. As a result, the church in the East that is led from Persia and is now will later be centered at Baghdad, but was centered at Ctesiphon in Mesopotamia, finds itself under significant persecution, guilt by association. And so this eventually leads to the destruction of much of the church in the East. And the Crusades remain seen as a great offense against Islam today, both by many Muslims and by many non-Muslims in Europe and in the Americas. People tend to view this as really, really bad behavior today, that these are a great evil. And there's certainly plenty of reasons to think that that's not actually an accurate way to think about this. The great historian of the Middle East, Bernard Lewis, says, quote, "The Crusades could more accurately be described as a limited, belated, and in the last analysis, ineffectual response to the jihad, a failed attempt to recover by a Christian holy war what had been lost to a Muslim holy war," unquote. That's Bernard Lewis. The historian Thomas Madden says, quote, "Now put this down in your notebook because it will be on the test. The Crusades were in every way a defensive war. They were the West's belated response to the Muslim conquest of fully two-thirds of the Christian world," unquote. So the Crusades also are part of a larger beginning of people in Western Europe to start to push outward in a more military way in defense of or in support of the faith. This began the process of what we call today the Reconquista, the reconquest of Iberia, the Iberian Peninsula, what is now Spain and Portugal, which was not complete until the fall of Granada in 1492. Under Ferdinand and Isabella, who also sent a guy named Columbus on an exploratory expedition. And various popes during this era and later gave people credit for going on a crusade when they went to other things, when they went to fight in some places in Northern Europe, fighting the Moors in Spain, doing things with and around other unevangelized people. So let's take a moment, next slide, and take a quick look just at the whole crusade thing. So this is just 1096 to 1204, and the Crusader era doesn't end until 1291. But these are the four big crusades, and they're not the first four because there are multiples that are in and among these. The first crusade really is not the one we call the first crusade. It's something that happened the same year but a few months earlier called the People's Crusade. The People's Crusade comes out of what is now Germany, the center of the Holy Roman Empire, and is sort of a populist attempt to create sort of a people's army. And with the idea that it could march to Constantinople and from there across Anatolia and down through Syria and all the way to Jerusalem, basically in the power of its religious fervor. And so the People's Crusade involved families and all manner of people who knew nothing about being in the military. It was more of a mass protest or something, people marching together to feel good. In any case, they eventually fell into a fight with the Seljuk Turks and were massacred and never made it anywhere close to Jerusalem. And very few people survived from the People's Crusade. And many of the other crusades resulted in similar disasters. In great loss of life without the actual accomplishment of anything in particular. And so there's a real focus here, though, on places mentioned in the New Testament. There's no attempt to recover the whole early Christian world, not a great attempt here. There's no attempt ever to recover Alexandria, which, of course, was perhaps the greatest city of the faith in the 3rd and 4th centuries. There is a huge focus here on Jerusalem or things that are related to Jerusalem. And most of these are very poorly planned use of expeditionary forces, and from a military perspective are not well organized or well thought out. But the First Crusade launches in 1096 based on the Pope's call in 1095. Pope Urban II set that into motion. And the First Crusade eventually conquers, finds a way to conquer Jerusalem after some long and winding and difficult time. Acre, the city that becomes kind of the key coastal city as the pivotal support point north of Caesarea Maritima. Antioch, and the First Crusade conquers all the way out here to Edessa. So this is the high water of the Crusader states. This is the most territory that was ever held during the 2 centuries of the Crusades. And there's only limited attempts. There was one attempt to conquer Damascus and one attempt to conquer part of Egypt, basically to use it as a base. But uh, But there's a huge amount of back and forth, and very little of this time are these stable borders. But this results in four kingdoms being established in the Middle East that Europeans attempt to support. But the First Crusade, you know, the casualties were high. They didn't establish particularly strong or well-defended states. And after about 1099, most of the Crusaders went home, leaving Jerusalem and Edessa and Antioch and Tripoli and Acre not well-defended at all and relatively lightly populated. People who were part of these crusades often thought of it as a short-term commitment. I will go and spend a few years fighting, and then I will go home. And so there was no real ability to establish a long-term presence. So half a century later, 1147 to 1149, you get a second big crusade, which sends significant forces to Jerusalem and Antioch and attempts to conquer Damascus, which fails and ultimately does not achieve any significant goal. The period 1189 to 1192 is regarded as the Third Crusade. The Third Crusade is famous because of who went. The Third Crusade, Frederick Barbarossa, the Holy Roman Empire, the emperor himself, goes on the Third Crusade. He drowns crossing a river in Turkey and never makes it to the Holy Land, and most of his German forces go turn around and go home after that. Frederick had sent a message to the Muslim caliph challenging him to battle before he set out from what is now Germany, but he drowned in a river partly because he was on the march wearing his armor and fell from his horse while crossing the river. Richard I of England came on this, who we now know as Richard the Lionhearted. And, of course, there's a whole bunch of stories with which you have some familiarity, which are set in England during the time that Richard was gone on the crusade, having to do with his corrupt brother and a guy named Robin who lived in the woods. In any case, all that is set in that time. The reason that Richard actually went was he made a deal with Philip II, the King of France. Those two were intermittently at war, and both of them said, I won't go unless he does, because I'm not leaving home if he's sticking around, because he will take advantage. So they had to make a pact to go together, even though they were at war with one another. So the Third Crusade put troops into Antioch and Acre. Jerusalem, of course, had been reconquered by Saladin, and they made an attempt to recover Jerusalem, which failed. They got within sight of the city briefly before they retreated. They did achieve a treaty with the Muslim leader Saladin, who is based in Egypt at the time, that allowed Christian pilgrims access to Jerusalem again for the first time in three centuries. So that was actually an outcome that the whole Crusades thing was really about. So there was a success built into that, but not really a military one. And then 1202 to 1204 is what is known as the Fourth Crusade, which was a complete disaster. The Fourth Crusade was not adequately funded. The troops were sent to Venice because the Venetians had the shipping needed to move them around the Mediterranean. When they got to Venice, the Doge, the leader of Venice, said, you're going to have to pay for this. And they didn't have any money to pay. And so he said, well, you're going to have to fight for me for a while to pay your way. And so he sent them to conquer a city that he wanted control of that was filled with Christians. So they found themselves fighting other Christians. They eventually made their way to Constantinople, where they got entangled in Byzantine dynastic politics and eventually sacked the city of Constantinople and killed many Christians there. They never made it any further than Constantinople, and all the people that were killed by the Crusaders of the Fourth Crusades were actually Christians. So that was a catastrophe that is unrivaled in this period. They briefly succeeded in imposing a Latin Christianity in Constantinople. That is, they briefly imposed on Constantinople that the liturgy should be said in Latin and not Greek, and that they should look to the Pope at Rome instead of the Patriarch in Constantinople. A fifth crusade was launched in 1217 to 1221, which is mostly focused on Acre, and then got tracked in a sidetrack on maybe we should go to Egypt and see if we could conquer Egypt and use that as a base. That didn't go well. The real reason why this didn't turn into complete catastrophe is it's at the time that Genghis Khan is operating in Central Asia, and the Muslim forces are thinking a lot more about that than they are about these Europeans. In any case, Acre falls in 1291. That ends the Crusader states and attempts to recover Jerusalem during the medieval era. This is never really about defeating Islam. But it's an offense that, you know, almost 1,000 years on, more than 800 years on, depending on which part you're focused on, remains offensive to many, many people around the world, and not just Muslims. The Crusades have gotten a really bad name down through the years, and it's partly because the Crusaders committed, you know, tremendous war crimes and did horrible things, and in many cases did so to other Christians as opposed to Muslims or other unbelievers. In any case, next slide. So this is part of this story of, you know, Islam in the West, and it's a thing that people tend to focus on. The Crusades are subsequently followed by continuing advance in many places on the part of Islamic forces, which continue to flow towards Europe. The next century is the period from about 1300 to 1700 is a time where there is mostly Muslim advance. There is slow Muslim decline in the Iberian Peninsula, the Muslim forces continue to press on Constantinople and continue to move towards the west into Europe. 7 centuries of warfare against the Eastern Roman Empire, what we call the Byzantine Empire, finally ends when Constantinople falls after a siege in 1453. After 7 centuries of the Arab Muslim and Turkish Muslim forces attacking, that city finally falls, which ends the Roman Empire. A millennia after the city of Rome has fallen, and the last Roman emperor is killed in defense of the city, and his body is never found. This leads to Muslim armies crossing into Europe. In 1529, Vienna is besieged. The Muslim armies are thrown back. In 1565, a great Muslim expeditionary force attempts to seize Malta, where Paul was shipwrecked, south of Sicily in the central Mediterranean. There is a great siege, tremendous story. We'll come back and maybe talk about that a couple of weeks from now. But a defeat in Malta was intended to. The Muslim forces there were sent from from the east with the intent to use Malta as a springboard for an invasion of Italy and the conquest of Rome. And Italy was functionally undefended. If Malta had fallen, it is likely that Muslim armies would have landed in Italy and would have taken control of the city of Rome in the 1560s, 1570s, and could have marched up the Italian peninsula from there. And the Renaissance, as we know it, would have ended very differently than it did. In 1683, Vienna was besieged again by Muslim armies, still attempting to invade Central Europe. That siege lasted for 2 months and was only broken by a joint attack of the forces of the Holy Roman Empire, led by the emperor himself, and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. It was the first time that they had ever fought together instead of against one another. It was the two largest armies in Europe that combined to eventually throw back the Muslim forces. So this is, up until 1700, this is an ongoing threat that people in Europe feel, that the Muslims are coming, the Saracens, the Arab and Turkish Islamic forces are coming, and we may not be able to do anything about that. After about 1700, things start really flowing back the other way. After the defeats at Malta, the great naval battle of Lepanto in 1571 and the huge Muslim loss there, the defeats at Vienna, the Muslim world kind of turns inward. There's some military deterioration, political stasis. The great era of the Islamic world runs from about AD 800 up till about 1400 or so. And by 1700, the Muslim world is in some decline. But before then, in the great era, the Muslim world is a pioneer of astronomy, mathematics, the invention of algebra, medicine. It is in the Muslim world at this time that somebody learns how to diagnose breast cancer and do a mastectomy. Optics, translations of many ancient documents, which are preserved only in Arabic in those eras. Many things that we know today about the ancient world are preserved because in that period they were translated into Arabic and then they were available later and might otherwise have been lost. Accumulation of very large libraries, art, calligraphy, mosaics. So why did this all fall by the wayside? Why did the Muslim world fall into such a decline? Well, the Mongols came out of Central Asia, leading to the siege of Baghdad and the destruction of Baghdad and the great library there in 1258. The Turks became the leaders rather than the Arabs. And conquered the Middle East and then North Africa in the early 1500s. And there just became a lot more conformity, a lot less initiative, and a slow decline where across this whole era, there ended up being the economies became increasingly dependent on slavery and raiding. And so when we think about this as Americans, we think about the Barbary Wars. The states along the coast of North Africa, the Muslim states, became focused on raiding and slave taking. The Barbary Corsairs, they really became pirate kingdoms, capturing thousands of merchant ships, raiding coastal towns. Coastal towns vanished in Spain and Italy for centuries because of the fear of Muslim raiders. There's a town, the town of Baltimore in Ireland, was carried off almost to a person by a great Muslim raiding fleet and was not reestablished for centuries. So the number of people who were enslaved in raids over the 500 years or so is probably north of a million, and not just Europeans, Africans, but the Barbary states made their money and built their economy based on slavery and slave trading, and using slaves as galley slaves to power their ships. The first U.S. war, the first time the United States got entangled in a war against an Islamic foe, and the first time, you know the story about the American president who, without the approval of Congress or the United Nations, launched a military assault on a Muslim nation was not necessarily popular. That president, of course, was Thomas Jefferson, because Thomas Jefferson, without even telling his cabinet, much less the Congress, launched a war against the Barbary States in 1801. It was actually basically the first thing that he did when he became president in 1801, was launch the war against the Barbary States. Part of the issue was that in 1800, 20% of the U.S. federal budget had been paid as tribute to the Barbary States. And Jefferson said, "I'm not paying anymore. I'm building a navy, and we're going to fight." So that is foundational to the establishment of the United States Navy. But Barbary piracy didn't end until the conquest of Algeria by France in 1830. That's what led to the end of organized piracy in the Western Mediterranean. In any case, this is a period when European states begin to fight back, and you start a colonial era, colonial conquest. The Ottoman Empire joins with Germany in World War I and ends up on the losing side and is dismembered at the end of the war. In a peace deal which has been memorably called the Peace to End All Peace, but which established the modern states of Iraq, Iran, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, what became the United Arab Emirates. All those borders come from that era and those deals in the early, in the post-World War I era. So this leads to, you know, some significant building of Muslim inferiority and sense that, you know, some establishment of Arab nationalism. And now we see, late 20th, early 21st century, we see the pushback, Islamicist terror, the sense that this is the only way to hit back. And that most of the terror stuff that we see is the action of people who think that they're basically powerless and that they don't have other options. And, of course, we are now witnessing the Taliban, who are, uneducated and poorly equipped tribesmen who have defeated in a 20-year war the most advanced military in history in Afghanistan. And from the Taliban's perspective, this isn't just a defeat of the United States. This is a defeat of Christianity. They see this as a religious thing and as a logical precursor to the conversion of every Afghan Christian back to Islam. That's a logical outcome. And so there is still a look to, worldwide conversion to Islam is part of the perspective that the Quran has given to to Muslims in general. And so these are very difficult things to talk about. The conflict has just been endemic down through the years. There's a whole lot of focus on whose fault, which hasn't been very helpful. But there has been a real inability to forgive or forget offenses that are far in the past here. And really different folks here on conversion and evangelization. From a Muslim perspective, conversion should be mass conversion and it should be imposed because it should be from the perspective of a united religious, political, military arrangement. And the Christian perspective has become very different than that, that conversion is an individual experience that happens to individual people and needs to happen in a setting where there is some tolerance. And so that's a big, complicated, very difficult thing to talk about. Huge controversies built into that, things that make people exceptionally angry. But there's a real tendency here on the part of so many people in the West to look at about AD 700 as the beginning of the story. With all of North Africa and the Middle East under Muslim control, that's the standard, that's the starting point, and that we ought to respect that as the place that everything begins. But from the Christian perspective, from the story of the church, that's not the beginning. And so we see the great history that the church has in many of those places. So